I forget whether I did say these exact words this time, but I have the little thing I always say at the beginning of any of my sessions, and that's that I reserve the right to completely change the session at any point during the session. I want to do that. And
because I closed it before, now someone will come and close it, and you'll sort of look there and say, why are they closing the door?
Just on the concept of emergence, ever so briefly, I was fascinated by the little display of networking brochures with all the heads neatly lined up. And they are, of course, all separate brochures. But anyhow, those sorts of things. This is how I live my life. I wander around, I see things like that, and I just sort of... Anyhow, I was faced, well, still am at this point in time, with the likelihood of giving you, at this point in time, a bad talk on communities in practice. And I thought, I'd rather not do that. I'd rather give you a good talk on communities of practice, because you'd probably like it more. And I'd feel happier doing it. And my mindset from this morning was pretty much focused on what you just heard. So I'm going to repeat what I... No, I'm just kidding. Now, I have promised you... Now, you guys are all here tomorrow too, right? Oh, man.
Some people are coming tomorrow.
Well, the majority. Oh. No, I know. I certainly understand that. Rats. See, what I wanted to do, of course, this would come as a big surprise to the people tomorrow who aren't even here to express their views, is save the communities of practice till tomorrow when I can do it justice and do the new student today. But of course, people will be coming tomorrow expecting the new students and getting communities of practice and they'll be going, what? What do you guys think I should do?
I think we had the chance to put your community in practice in an order that would feel really bad, and then people are going to want to be tomorrow.
Okay, there is really a good communities of practice audio on my site already, but how badly will you be upset if I change the topic? Oh man, I hate this dilemma. Are you sure? It's still a good talk. And do try to come back tomorrow, because the communities of practice one is quite a good talk. You can. Oh man. I feel really badly about that. I blame Microsoft, of course. It will be a good talk. Of course, I say that now. All right, I will go with the majority. I really would rather give you a good talk on a subject you weren't expecting than a bad talk on a subject that you were. Because, quite frankly, I won't be able to do the communities of practice properly right now. It's just, I won't. So... Yeah, sure. Royalty free.
Copyright
free. You can, I don't know, show it to your cat. All right. Okay. Like I said, it's going to be one of those days. I woke up this morning, and I like to leave the TV on because I'm an information junkie. And I'm not really concerned about whether I'm conscious, just so long as I have information coming in. And the TV was on some channel. I walked out into the living room because they had given me this nice suite. There's no restaurant, so I can't get breakfast, but I have two rooms. I'd rather have one room and breakfast, but we'll leave that aside. And first thing I do is I look at the screen and it says something like, you will be caught unprepared. I'm like, great. That's how I'm going to start my week. And then I look and thought, it said Sagittarius. I went, oh, that's for a different sign anyways. It's that kind of day. That's kind of like being right, but without being justified. Now, where did it go? Here we go. All right. Now, actually, I'm going to skip a bit lightly over parts of this because it wasn't really part of the presentation that you were promised, but aspects of this do have to do with quality, because I think the two things, well, as it turns out, they do kind of merge. So I'm kind of after two themes in this talk. As I say, I'll skip a bit more lightly over the quality parts, and I'll linger a little bit more over the new student parts. But the two things are related. There is, like somebody commented before, the first part was a little kind of philosophical, more philosophical and less practical, although, of course, I think stuff like that is eminently practical. But this, I think, you'll find more practical and less philosophical, although, of course, in my mind, anything that is practical is inherently philosophical, but that's just me. So part of the theme is, what is quality? How do we achieve it? How do we measure for it? Now, that's practical, and the answer isn't standardized tests. And I wish I could remember the person who spoke at ACE on Saturday. The neat thing he had to say about standardized tests that I kind of liked was that there is no empirical evidence whatsoever that they actually predict achievement, which is interesting. The main thing is the new student. What makes today's student different? And by different, I mean different from ourselves. That's assuming that all of us are older than the new student, who would therefore be younger than us. And more importantly, more practically, how do we teach them? And I think this will be of direct relevance to the educational designers here. So, preliminaries. What counts as quality depends on what we're trying to do, what our objectives are. And what counts as quality in e-learning, therefore, depends on what the outcomes or the objectives of e-learning are. And what those are depends very much on who you ask. And of course, based on this morning's, or before the break talk, if you ask me what e-learning is, that's going to be very different from the people that say tacit knowledge, who will say something very different. We've already seen part of this. Why do we bother with e-learning at all? Why do we bother with learning at all? Well, the one view that I've kind of already trashed is the content view. The amassing in students of a basic set of knowledge and skills. But we also hear an awful lot about the economic view of learning, that we're preparing people for gainful employment. And if you've read my talk from Saturday on my website, you know kind of what I think of that. I don't think a whole lot of that. And then there's another view, and we see this instantiated probably more in the private sector than in the public sector, ironically, because that seems to me just backwards. The idea of learning is fostering a set of cultural or moral values. And this is not just religious values, but how to be a good citizen, that you should go vote, things like that. Of course, they have other methods of doing that here in Australia, but I've had the election on my brain too, because it was really neat watching an election in another country, because you don't really get the opportunity. So I stuck my head into one of the polling places just to see. It's just like in Canada. There's a bunch of people walking around, papers, and it all looks very disorganized, but everybody's also nice and polite and civil. And I love votes and voting. I really do. Okay. More philosophy. Not much more. My own view of learning, first and most importantly, and this might, I'll forget the qualifications. Learning cannot, should not, must not be subsumed to the values of a certain sector of society. And this comes from Rousseau. Now, Rousseau's argument in the social contract is, if you assign the management of learning to a certain segment of society, then that segment of society will take learning and translate it in order to fulfill their own self-interests. In other words, learning assigned to the role of a certain segment of society is turned around to promote the interests of that segment. So, learning should express the social good. And what is the social good? The best expression of the social good, in my mind, is through the individual good, or as Mill says, to pursue one's own good in one's own way. There aren't things, in my mind, that are social values over and above individual values. Now, based on the first talk, you know that that's kind of a subtle view. It doesn't mean that there are no social values. It means that what we consider as social values are in fact emergent from the aggregation of individual values. So that we can say there are social values, but they are not in fact over and above the individual values. So what this amounts to is that the evaluation of learning should be on a society-wide basis. But it should be framed from the point of view of individual aspirations. All of this is a fancy way of saying it should be student-centered. It should be based on the needs and the interests of the students. And it should be measured, the quality of learning should be measured in terms of capacities rather than content. What they can do rather than what they can put on a test. What their, if you will, their dispositions are rather than what their inherent properties are. How well, I say, a student can negotiate a diverse, changing, information-rich culture. To me, the measure of quality in learning isn't something like test results. It's things like crime rates. It's things like health and health statistics. An educated population is a healthier population. It's things like personal satisfaction in careers. A person who is a school dropout but who achieves a full and satisfying life as an artist is, in my mind, an educational success. And probably in that person's mind as well. So when we're looking at e-learning, well, typically we compare it to traditional learning, but what we're trying to show, in a sense, is that it's more effective than traditional learning and more efficient than traditional learning. Yeah, I don't like that slide. Sorry, I wanted to skip lightly over the quality parts, and this is me trying to skip lightly over the quality parts. And every time I try to skip lightly over something, I realize that there's something that I haven't said, and I really should say it, otherwise it won't make sense. But I need to be careful, because otherwise we'll be here till 4 o'clock. And I don't want to do that either. But I do want to talk about this, because this speaks to something very practical. And the practicality here is the measurement of mechanisms or means of designing e-learning. And the big thing that's sweeping Canada anyways, and it's kind of sweeping the United States with this whole No Child Left Behind Act, and it's sort of sweeping Australia a little bit, is the measurement of learning by outcomes. And the principle behind that is something called the Campbell Collaboration. And they may not be saying it to you guys depending on what they're saying, but they are saying it among themselves at the administration level. The Campbell Collaboration is based on a thing called the Cochrane Collaboration, which evolved in the field of medicine. And the idea here is that if you want to implement a new strategy, such as the random ringing of phones in a classroom, what you do is you have a control group and a test group. You change one variable in the test group, then you measure for outcomes, and if the outcomes are better, the change that you made was worthwhile, and you should keep it. And it's all based on a grand myth, right? And the myth is that education, or for that matter, health, is something where you can isolate one variable and change it and direct that to the output or the result. If you buy what I said this morning, then learning is not a simple cause-effect kind of thing. You don't push in inputs and then get outputs. Because if you're pushing in the input, you're pushing it into this complex network of mixed concepts and ideas and so on. And what you push in one person is going to have a very different effect than what you push in the other person. And the outputs are going to be wildly different. Moreover, the empirical evidence that we have so far with respect to learning, and this is Australia specific because it's cited in the report by the Vice Chancellors, is that The major input to learning, to produce effective learning, appears to be social and economic background. I recommended, in fact, it was a U.S. document, directly correlating learning outcomes with hot lunches. So people ask me, well, what should we do to improve education? I tell people, feed students. It really seems sort of obvious and logical. That's practical, right? But it turns out to be a hard thing to get them to do in the United States. I don't know why. They want a good education. They should feed students. The other recommendation is less practical, right? Give them richer parents. But it's interesting because the Australian Vice Chancellor's report said, you know, there is, you know, a clear correlation between social economic background and learning achievement. The same report said there is a clear segregation in the Australian school system of schools based on social and economic background. Okay, well, no surprise really. It's a little bit like that in Canada, because you put the school in the rich area and all the rich people go, you put the school in the poor area and all the poor people go. Then the vice chancellors went on and said, there is a clear correlation between schools and learning outcome. Therefore, it must be something the schools are doing. I said, what? Think about this. The schools are segregated by social and economic background. Social and economic background is the clearest indicator of educational outcomes. Therefore, it's the school? Of course not. Right? There's a difference between schools because the schools have different students, not because of what the schools are doing. So I've just covered this one. Okay. All of that now is in the background. Like I say, it's hypertext presentations. Put that in the background, because I really don't think it's what the schools are doing. But now we look at who it is that we're teaching to. Now, who it is that we're teaching to are the students who are growing up in today's media environment. Today's media environment is very different even from the environment I had when I was a kid. I have to say it that way, because otherwise I say it's completely changed. And that says, I'm so old, I don't remember television. That's not true, but When I was growing up, we had black and white television. That was it. And all the shows were in black and white, too. Today, we had CBC and CTV at home. And then a great day happened in my life. We got a third network called Global. That was so good, because they would broadcast the World Hockey Association games when nobody else would. Today, except in Australian hotel rooms, it's a 600-channel TV universe. In Australia, it's still three channels in the hotel rooms. I'm just kidding a little bit, but not much. Is it the same at home? Okay. Elsewhere, at home, quite literally, I have more than 100 channels I can choose from. It's not basic cable. It's slightly more than basic cable, but still. I mean, I'm paying like something like, well, for cable plus high-speed internet, I'm paying about $40 a month. So, like, for me, for people in Canada anyways, in the United States and Europe, although not so much so in Europe, because their hotel TV choices are just as bad, it really is a 600-channel universe. It's a 10,000-station radio universe, and that's for everyone, because we have webcasting now. And sometimes it even works over dial-up, although not very well. And for everyone, it's something like an 8 billion page internet. The range of choices has dramatically increased. And even if you only have like three channels here in Australia now, that's not going to last. That will change. Has to change. More to the point, media is ubiquitous. There was a time when I was a kid that I could actually escape to a place, and not just in the middle of the forest, where there was no media, where I wasn't exposed to advertising. Now I notice there's no place in Perth practically you can go without seeing that big advertisement on the side of the building. I assume that's an advertisement. I've been deliberately not looking at it, but it's a great big white screen of some sort. You're all looking at me puzzled. It's like a great big screen on the side of a building that'd be 10 stories high. If you haven't noticed. Now that is interesting. But think, if you think about it, you know, I'm sort of looking at the slide, but this is an analogy I play quite a bit, so I like to linger on it. It's like, remember when, and some of you might not, but remember when you would go to a place in order to read. Go to the reading room, or go to the library. Even people my age will probably remember the time when they would go to the TV room. Do you guys have TV rooms? No? You have living rooms, which is where the TV is located. When I was growing up, we had a room we called the TV room, and that was naturally the room the TV was in. It later evolved into the living room. I'm not sure what they had before TV rooms. Salons, maybe. Of course, they had reading rooms. The point here that I'm trying to make is that we've moved from an era where media was kind of something out there, but that we would go to it, where to an era where media now is coming to us, and coming to us in increasing volume, increasing frequency. It's, as they say, ubiquitous. Moreover, in this I'm sure you've all observed in your own lives, the pace has changed. I like this expression, but I don't like this expression. It's not my expression. It comes from people like Prensky and what's that guy who wrote Ditch? His name's not there. Oh, man. Real famous person. I should easily remember his name. Tapscott. John Tapscott. That was a case of trying to get some brain printing there, and it just wasn't in my head in the form of text. Students operate today at what's called twitch speed. Right? And of course, it comes from the joysticks that they use. Right? Twitch, 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 twitch. Anyhow, they expect, and this has been verified in numerous cases, instantaneous in access to information day or night. I read, there's a government thing, Government of Canada thing that I read, describing service standards, right? And they said, we will answer our phone within 3 rings, which I thought was pretty incredible. Right? We will respond to letters or email within 4 to 6 weeks. You understand that, but email within 4 to 6 weeks? I thought, what planet are these people on? People expect email responses within a 24-hour period, and if you don't answer within a 24-hour period, they think you've died. And I know this because I get people writing, are you okay? You didn't answer my email. And, of course, they expect access to information to be instantaneous, immediate, there, day or night. Has TiVo hit here? No. TiVo. Big T, little I, big V, little O. What TiVo is a thing that you plug into your television, and it will record television programs for you. And then you can, it's like a VCR, except it will also blot out all the commercials. It's kind of like a digital television recorder where you tell it what to record, and then it'll come back and program. It'll play you your programs when you ask it. TiVo has other features too. TiVo guesses. TiVo looks at the things that you've recorded and says, well, you might like this. And so it goes out and it independently records things for you just in case you might like them, and then it suggests them to you. Which has led to a whole bunch of interesting stories, like the person who accidentally left the TV on while a John Wayne movie was playing. Completely by accident. Now TiVo thinks he likes westerns. He's trying to push westerns on him. And then there's the other person who watched my beautiful laundrette because he thought it was about, you know, industry and laundries. Yeah. And you know where TiVo's going with that one. anyhow, the idea of TiVo and the idea of video on demand, which is something that's approaching very rapidly, is, of course, instantaneous access to information. You don't need to wait for the next Star Trek episode. It's just there when you want it. And, of course, and I know this is the case in Australia, they expect to be in communication with anyone at any time. It's the funniest thing. I was in this bus, or this coach, in Tasmania, and of course, going from the east to the west, we're kind of out of contact for a while. Came back into the contact into the contact zone, and everybody's phone said beep 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 beep. All the ringtones went at once. Everybody on the bus had one of these things, but me, because I hate telephones. But so I'm sitting there on this dark, late at night, and all I see are these lit phones. And some people are SMSing, some people are chatting, whatever. They expect to be, they found it odd and disturbing that they were out of contact. And as soon as we got back in, they're all on the phone. Every last one of them. There's a bus full of people. And only me, just me. And I was looking out the window trying to see the stars, and all I could see were the reflections from these phones. Access is, as they say, a given. Young people today expect access. They want access. They want access not just in terms of the wires and the bandwidth, although I'm sure you've probably already seen there's a lot of pressure from younger people for wires or bandwidth, or these days even more so, wireless and bandwidth. But they also expect to be able to access content instantaneously with the click of a hyperlink, which again is why digital rights management is so inherently flawed. I'm going to keep picking on this. Because it disrupts students' expectations of access. They expect to be able to click on a link and get a song. And anything, like typing in a login or having to pay or whatever like that, that interrupts that access is viewed by them as broken. It's not viewed by them as a necessary barrier in order to ensure the smooth functioning of economics and compensation for the artists. It's broken. And so that's why they take to things like Napster and Nutella and things like that. It's not so much because they object. I mean, there's surveys on it. They wouldn't care about paying for the song. They do care about paying rip-off prices for the song, but not nearly as much as you might think. I mean, this is the same generation that has, up until recently, bought CDs. So, you know, I mean, they're used to paying through the ears for it. But it's the interruption of access that is off-putting. And that's the part that the people in digital rights management haven't figured out yet, is that you create a barrier between the user and the information, you're basically making the information inaccessible, and they will route around it. This is not a prediction, this is an observation. They have routed around it. Digital rights management is technology that is broken. That simple. It's not simply that they expect access. They expect access to be a feature of their environment. I have this talk I do. I talk about the future state of learning. And I talk about learning being ubiquitous or ubiquitous. I can never figure out which way to go there. In the environment. And the analogy that I use is learning of the future is like writing of today. If I need to know something and I'm in an environment, there will be writing which informs me of that. Here's something. I honestly didn't know that that was there until I turned around, because I just turned around expecting there to be writing, and there it was. Presenters, please ensure you relay this information to your guests at the beginning of your presentation. Vital information. Toilets are located at the north end of the building near the computer lab. Now this, of course, context is everything. Which way is north? They say the north end. Why don't they put a big N on the wall so I know which way is north? It's like my hotel in Sydney. And they said, come out of the train station and go down Elizabeth Street. So I thought about that. I said, do you mean down a hill? And they said, no, you just go down, like away from the station. I'm thinking, okay, we have a station, we have a street. No matter which way you go on the street, you're going away from it. So I said, what direction am I going? North, south, east, or west? And I said, north. And I thought, great, okay, now I'm set. So I go to Sydney, I come out of the train station, I'm standing on Elizabeth Street, and I realize I don't know which way north is. I'm thinking as I'm standing there, why don't I have a big arrow that says north? That would be so useful, but no. And so if you go out that door, you will not see a big arrow that says north. You'll see a very small sign in writing that says toilets. So on and so forth.
I won't read the next one, because I've already violated it.
The point I'm making is, this kind of access to information in the environment, when and where you want it and expect it, is what the so-called new student expects. It's actually what I expect. Whereby information, and in our field, learning, will be as present in the environment as writing on the wall. Now, if I wanted to learn about, suppose I'm in the toilet, I want to know how toilets work, the learning will be available for me there. And you might think, well, why would I want to learn about toilets while I'm in the toilet? And my thinking is, where else would I be interested? Like, to me, that's the place where learning about toilets should occur. That's where the instructions on how to use the toilet are. You wouldn't find instructions on how to use the toilet in the main hall. You certainly, and the key point here is, you certainly would not go to a classroom and take a 30-hour course in order how to learn how to do something that basic. And this is the way the new generation views learning. That the concept of stopping whatever it is that you're doing, going to a different place, setting aside time, accessing digitally protected content that you can only view when you're in a special room on a special computer. This is a system that is viewed as completely and irrevocably broken. And it works completely against their ideas of access to information. I'm standing in front of my slides again, aren't I? So you can always tell when I start seeing the bright lights. It's either the second coming or I'm in front of the projector. The catchphrase is instant gratification, but that's not how it's viewed. The view is like, why the wait? Because with today's technology, there is utterly no reason whatsoever why the learning isn't present where we need it. And if you think about it, it's true. Wireless access. In addition to the internet services you already have in your college or university, wireless access will cost you the grand total of one computer. Maybe two, depending on the size of the building. And a little wireless. Actually, you don't even need the computers. All you need are the little hubs. It's dirt cheap to provide. When you compare the cost of that thing, the cost of that thing itself would equal the cost of providing wireless access for this whole building. So students say, wireless access. Why isn't there wireless access? Right? They probably don't want us to have it. It's not that it's too expensive. It's not that we don't know how to do it. They must not want us to have it. So there should be wireless access in the bathroom. Why isn't there a little monitor in the bathroom with everything we need to know about how to use the bathroom? I don't know if you call them bathrooms here, but I do, so you're stuck with it. Well, and it's not like little wall monitors are expensive either. I mean, children have them. So again, it must be, they don't want you to have that information here. Well, that's right, she said she was leaving. It was not an editorial content. Well, I mean, I've changed my mind on the fly like that too, so... This is kind of a neat bunch of statistics. 10,000 hours playing video games. My own experience is that that's low. 20,000 hours watching TV. My own experience is that that's high. Certainly in Canada and the United States, TV viewership is on the decline. And more importantly, TV viewership is becoming what they call a background phenomenon, like radio is now. Used to be, people would sit around in the, well, I guess it wasn't the TV room then, and it wasn't the reading room, because they weren't reading, but they would sit around in the sitting room and listened to the radio. But then TV came out, radio faded to, you know, it's the kind of thing that you play in the background so that you have noise so that you can concentrate on whatever else you're doing. It drowns out all the other sounds. Now TV is becoming like that. TV is what's on while you're playing your video game and chatting with your friends using Instant Messenger. 20,000 hours talking on the phone. I don't know whether that's true or not. Who knows? Well, you guys probably know better than I do. I just don't keep track of phone usages because, again, I don't like phones. As compared to 5,000 hours reading, which is probably... Well, I don't know if Worming is counting web time as reading time. If you count web time as reading time, it's probably higher. And only 11,000 hours attending school. And again, that's very optimistic, right? I remember when I was in university, it took by great force of effort, and I actually put a little chart on the wall, put a little X every time I attended classes, and I was able to get myself up to attending about 60% of my classes by disciplining myself. And it changes their outlooks. It changes their attitudes. It changes what they learn, where they learn it from. From this same report, today's kids' values are not and will not be inculcated. That was the first time I had said that word, too, when I first read this. By the family, the church, or other institutions in either the present or the future. They are and will continue to be developed by the electronic and visual media. This is where they will learn many of the social skills as they've become increasingly immersed, that's the key word, in the new digital landscape. And I look at stuff like that and I say to myself, why are we focusing on learning that is based around some sort of separate place that we send kids to, or even adults for that matter, for a short period of time in order to learn? Why do we do it that way? It's certainly not going to be, it's regardless of whether it's effective, it's going to be completely drowned out by all the other media that they take part in. A big part of what I'm about, so far as e-learning is concerned, is I'm virtually not interested in schools anymore. I'm interested in content networks in such a way that we can stream the learning into the information network that they're already accessing. That seems to me to be the more effective way to go. Mind you, we'd have some issues with digital rights and protecting textbooks and stuff like all that stuff is more important. So let's look at what we're doing. And here's the longer version of the same statement. Learning, right now, is segregated from everything else. It's synchronous, time-based, and limited. It starts, it stops. It's offered in a structural, linear form. Even in e-learning, we use things like WebCT and Blackboard and here Janison, where it's organized in terms of classes and courses, and naturally is predominantly content-based. Well, from the stuff I talked about before the break, you can see why, for a wide range of reasons, why I think that this approach to learning is misconstrued. But the point of this part of the talk is, even if it was well-construed, it's still not reaching the target audience. It's still being only a very minor factor in their lives. It's still almost irrelevant. Almost. Not quite. But here we have the stuff about outcomes that I talked about a bit earlier. Because what's happening in schools is so minimally a part of students' lives, we would expect that what happens in schools to have almost no impact on educational outcomes. And when we look at the study, and it's study after study, we find that this is the case. The only place where schools seem to have a measured outcome is with these standardized tests. But these standardized tests are in very limited circumstance, in a very limited place, and I haven't seen the evidence that this learning lingers. I certainly haven't seen the evidence that there is any grade 12 student who knows mathematics as well as they know MIST. For those of you who don't understand the reference, MIST, M-Y-S-T, is a computer game where you have to learn all the ins and outs and details and secret pathways and passages and passwords and stuff for a fictional made-up land. And students know all about that. This is from a paper by Jukes and Dosage. There's a link in here, and this slideshow is on my website, and I'll make it available in a new link as well. It's becoming increasingly evident that there is a fundamental disconnect between the way kids think, learn, and communicate, and the ways that schools interact with them. So the big question is, okay, if what we're doing isn't working, and I think there's plenty of evidence that shows that, the United States are talking about a full-blown educational crisis, to which their reaction, of course, was to go backwards. But how do they learn? That's not really the intermission. Okay. Now we're going to get something that is the practical implementation of a lot of what I talked about before the break. There's two major features of what people are calling the MTV mindset. One is the emphasis on the non-textual, the spatial, and the visual. People who are growing up in this information-rich environment are being presented with, and in my opinion, therefore, thinking in terms of non-visual phenomenon much more. They're thinking more in pictures. They're thinking more in audio, in music. And the second thing, and this is also a characteristic of MTV, how many of you have seen MTV? Let me ask that. Okay, well, that's about half. In a sense, you have to see MTV to get it. But what MTV does and what leads to the characterization of the MTV generation is they don't just give you one thing and you watch it. A music video isn't like that. A music video is this mixture of sound and images, sometimes texts, sometimes many images, all juxtaposed. I hate that word. I had it the first time, eh? The idea here is it isn't in a nice, neat, organized package. It's just coming at you. The paradigm of this for me is a song by Van Halen that came out a number of years ago called Right Now. Anyone remember that? So anyhow, the song's going on right now. It's Eddie Van Halen and David Lee Roth wailing the way they do. And then there's this stream of images coming along. It's like, you know, people tying their shoe, people trying to catch a fish, a baby being born. And then there's this string of text coming across the bottom with a very different message. And the idea is that all of these things are being presented in the same place at the same time. And so the viewers are actually receiving the input on multiple tracks. They're receiving one message visually, another message through their ears, another message cognitively. And the idea is that the concepts that are being created in their minds are concepts that are certainly subtextual and to a degree almost subliminal. They are, as I would describe from this morning, they're emergent. They're being built out of a combination of these multiple media being aimed at them. And this phrase here, this sentence here, is basically the point of my morning talk, that it isn't text-based, it isn't content-based anymore. It's all to students, to the younger generation these days, it's all ones and zeros. It's all the same. It's not text or video or audio. It's all just information. It comes into the same place and it just gets smooshed together. Again, I'm trying to find the right words to express this, and I'm not doing as well a job as I would like, but the important thing here is that it is a single experience. Talked a bit about neural networks. There's a concept in neural networks called plasticity, which is, in a short form, the idea that the connections between neurons in the brain changes. And one of the ways that it changes is according to a principle called Hebbian associations, named after Donald Hebb, who's a Canadian psychologist. And a way of describing it is to say that if two neurons fire at the same time, then a connection to them is formed. So like attracts like, if you will. So if two concepts appear at the same time, two ideas appear at the same time, an association between them is formed. Advertisers know this. Advertisers use this a lot, which is why the advertisement for a car, which of course is aimed at, you know, young males 18 to 24, contains the picture of a beautiful woman. The beautiful woman, of course, is not part of the car. And not being sold along with the car, but the idea is to draw the association subliminally in the target audience's mind between the product and something that they want. So, and it's not generating the explicit knowledge, if I buy the car, I'll get the girl, because nobody believes that. But the idea here is to draw the association at a lower level, something more along the lines of, this is good, therefore this is good, although not even that explicit. Now, what's important here is that this is a slow process, not a fast process, which is why cramming for the test doesn't work. It's a process based on repetition, on experience, on practice. This is back to the Humean custom and habit again. The thing with habits is they take time to create and they take time to break, which is, of course, why I'm still smoking. It's the sort of thing that means the thing that occupies most of a person's time is going to carry more weight than the thing that occupies a little bit of a person's time. This talk, I could come in here and like do the best talk in the world, the talk that would always be remembered for the rest of your life. And that might even be the case. But what happens in your classroom is going to be more important because it happens more frequently, and it is the sort of thing that is going to form ultimately the basis for your knowledge and experience than anything I could say in here. All I can ever hope to do here is shade your experience of what happens, to try to alter your perceptions a little bit. But I know, standing here, that what you learn and what you know isn't going to be shaped by a 3-hour presentation. It's going to be shaped by your repeated experiences over and over again in your classroom. That's why I do a daily newsletter, because I want a piece of that regular experience. And that's how the learning, if I have learning to offer, will take place from me to you, not through a talk, but through the repetition, the constant exposure to certain ideas. There's all kinds of discussion in U.S. politics about how the Republicans have come to understand this and how the Democrats haven't. There's been a lot of work. What happened is, a number of years ago, the Republicans said, right in the middle of the 60s, we've lost the hearts and minds. And what they did is they didn't approach the problem from a perspective of logic. They didn't approach the problem, gee, if we just explain our platform, they'll understand that it's good and vote for us. Because that has long since ceased to work in politics. But what they did is they bought a bunch of TV and radio stations and started broadcasting the message. They bought a bunch of newspapers. They set up some institutes, some academic think tanks, to produce papers from their point of view, and so on. Basically, they hit all these media areas. And no single message coming from the Republican Party changes any minds. And nobody thinks it does. Well, some Democrats think it does, but it doesn't, really. But what it is it's creating the overall environment where their message is the thing that is being heard and seen most often. And it is the heard being heard and seen most often that is creating the political conversion that has happened in the United States. It has nothing, absolutely and utterly nothing to do with knowledge and argument and rationality in the traditional sense. And as educators, that is a fundamental point that we have to understand. You cannot convince people that things are true. You cannot show people and argue it out. Because people are resistant to argument, because that's not how their brain works. Their brain doesn't just say, oh, yeah, he was right. I guess there was no God. You know, the brain doesn't work that way. So it's the creation of an immersive environment. So my view with respect to schools and colleges, for that matter, is that we're actually making it harder for people to learn by taking the learning away from their lives and putting it in a special room. And even harder when you charge them money for it, right? And so you don't want them to learn. That's how you do it, is you put up a gate or a barrier or lock the front door. Learning, if it is going to be effective, has to be in their lives 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Well, if they leave their TV on overnight, but if they're in the information generation, they probably do. So, you know, those late night broadcasts, I have some nice knives at home. No, I'm just kidding. I've listened to a lot of music I never would have. Still don't like opera, though. I'll come back. There we go. There's more of the same message, right? Neural circuits are constantly strengthened or constantly weakened. The message has to be repeated over and over and over again. One place that got that right was Sesame Street. Sesame Street defined a generation. I'm pre-Sesame Street. So I'm talking by observation here, not experience. Now I'm dating myself. How many of you are Sesame Street kids? Yeah. It's okay. It's still running. You can put up your hand. Pardon?
Still are,
of course. Yeah. This program was brought to you by the letter A and the number 1 and by Kraft Dinner. No, wait. There was this sort of, and this is in my view, there was this subtle commercial overtone in Sesame Street. An overt commercial overtone in Disney cartoons. There's a whole world view in Disney. The Politics of Mickey Mouse, if you haven't read that, have a look at that. Again, getting the message into the media. If we want people to learn, we have to get the learning into the media. We've just done this, so I'm going to skip it. I'm skipping through these slides because mostly I covered these in the morning. I say morning. I guess it's afternoon now. The idea of content coming together. Emergence. The idea of multimedia. The thing about the paper that I just did on Saturday, because everybody's talking about learning objects, and a lot of you are involved in learning design, and the picture that's coming out is, okay, learning design is like putting things together like Legos or like atoms or whatever. But if you look at the actual practice of learning design, you can see that learning design really is like taking bits of learning and arranging it, like words in a sentence, like lines in a play. And it's treating learning material as though it were bits of text. But by contrast, the way media is presented and understood by the younger generation is not in this neat linear sequence. And the meaning does not come from the order of the words, the structuring of the course. Rather, the meaning, the material is presented to them as a melange, like an MTV video, like a rave, where everything's just coming at them. And the meaning emerges in the sense of emergence, as I talked about before the break this morning. As I say, the meaning of a painting coming out from the bits of paint on a canvas, the sand castle, the shape emerging from the organization of the grains of sand. That's more how the younger generation is perceiving, in my opinion, rather than in a linear fashion. And they perceive that way because that's how the media around them is structured. and they are reacting to and adapting to the media. It's not that they're becoming more stupid, or it's not that they're becoming illiterate. It's that their way of reading is reading what is in the environment, reading what is their experience, and that's what they experience.
Did you ask a question on that?
Yeah.
If one looks at media as a steady state, it's largely fed by an older generation. In somebody's description a while ago, there was the technology thing that's been invented since the war. But if you look at the people who are involved in journalism, for example, or many television and so forth, it comes from a my generation, but perhaps a generation in between. Are you suggesting that the kids, if we use that group to say that the students of today are assembling stuff out of
Oh, absolutely. The question for the microphone is, a lot of the information today being produced was by the older generation, and is the material being reassembled, irrespective of the intentions of the people that produced it? And I would say absolutely. Although there's a couple of strands to this, because I was going to go a different way until you said that very last sentence. But the one strand of it is, yes, absolutely, and that can be put under the heading of what's sometimes called the remix culture, where people pull things in, remix it, repurpose it, shape it to their own ends, and then ship it out as something new. And hip-hop is, and rap are basically based on that kind of remix culture. The other strand of it, too, is that mainstream media, in an important sense, is becoming increasingly irrelevant in these students' lives. Newspapers, which is one example you cited, are suffering a continual decline in readership. Television even is. And to a large degree, in addition to remixing what already exists in the culture, they are more and more creating their own media. I've written about and talked about the world of blogs. Blogs are basically writing by these people for themselves. It exists completely, almost completely out of the mainstream, but is a good example of the sort of thing that I'm talking about. Instant messages are completely out of the mainstream, but again, it's content being produced by them for themselves, and we're seeing that more and more. The web itself is, for the most part, the vast most part, the creation of a younger generation. I mean, IBM didn't build the web. Microsoft didn't build the web. Mostly, it's been built by younger people. I'm an oldster on the web. You know, see, you look at, we have the class list of people who graduated. The one I'm thinking of, people who graduated from the University of Calgary, and all the names. And if the person had a web page, they have a hyperlink to their web page. And so, you know, you go through, you know, the 50s and the 60s, there's no web pages and so on. Then there's mine, and then there's this other 10-year, 15-year gap before you hit the next web page. I'm the exception to a large degree. People who are building the web, actually building the web, are young people. RSS is something I talk about, Rich Site Summary. It's a type of communication language to syndicate the content of news, blog, and other websites. Some of the most important work in RSS was done by a guy called Aaron Schwartz. Aaron Schwartz, when I first heard of him, he was 13 years old and writing his own parsers. And he's a lot older now. I think he's 16 or 17. And he's one of the most important and respected names in the field. Quite literally, the knowledge economy is being rewritten under our noses. It's been rewritten to route around traditional media. Insofar as traditional media is being used, it is being dramatically remixed. That's what a blog is. A blog will take, in some cases, news from traditional media and twist it around, put it in context with other things, change the meaning of it so that it says something new, and importantly, it says something which is, to the reader, the remixer, more likely to be true than what it said when it was sitting there actually in the newspaper. Because in addition to routing around traditional media, there is, in my view, a widespread distrust and disbelief in traditional media. And, you know, from where I sit, for good reason. You know, this whole Dan Rather getting caught out with fake documents. I don't know how much of that you saw here in Australia, but a few weeks ago there was this big 60 Minutes report, and Dan Rather comes on and, "We have these documents. They prove that people made special deals to keep George Bush out of active service and get him into the National Guard." Well, the blogosphere went at it, and it took about 2 weeks, and Dan Rather had to come on and say, "Well, turns out we have no real reason for believing that these documents are real." And this is the sort of thing that's been happening over and over again in the blogosphere. Trent Lott, was it? U.S. House leader forced to resign because the blogosphere basically found a tiny, obscure reference to a racist speech that he had made. The media were all there. They had just ignored the racist remarks. And so there's this skepticism on the part of the younger generation, and in my view, a very much a justified skepticism. So, yeah, they take this content, they remix it, they rework it, they feed it forward, and they are quite literally creating the sort of network that I've described. And in the sort of network that I described before the break, information is always there. Information is less, well, the saying goes, 6 degrees of separation. That's the characteristic of the network. And actually, the internet is a small network, so really it should only be 3 or 4 steps away at most. And that's the way they expect to find anything, is that quickly, right away, and in a wide variety of shapes and formats. There are no authoritative voices anymore. The crowd is the authoritative voice. That's the new mindset. 12:30. Do you want me to continue or to stop and start again tomorrow? I can go on for a little while if you would like. Okay. I still think we've gotten to the point or to the heart of the talk about the new students anyways, and unfortunately we did only have an hour to deal with it, which was too bad. But tomorrow, for those of you who are back, a new and improved community of practice discussion. But you can see where I'm going with it, right? Right? Because if you think about community of practice on the picture described by, say, Hegel and Armstrong, where really what it is a corporate and commercial presence, you can just imagine how the new generation would look at that and question how you can do that in a distributed network environment. So that's largely what I'm going to be talking about. Those of you who are looking at my website, if you have a look at a paper called The Semantic Social Network, you'll see quite a bit of what my previous thoughts were, what my current thoughts are on what I call the evolving concept of the community of practice. This is especially for those of you who won't be here for this. I'm just trying to give you stuff, because I still feel really badly about not talking about it. And I've forgotten already what the other two talks were tomorrow. Anyone? It was on a piece of paper, which I actually saw in front of me, and then, oh, here we go.
Oh, yeah, personalization. Yeah, absolutely. That's good stuff. It issues me learning. I'm going to slam copyright a bit. Okay, to me, that's the only issue in e-learning, is copyright. That's the only issue. There are lots of other pseudo-issues, but copyright, patents, things like that, that is, to me, the only issue. Everything else follows. If we get copyright right, everything else is fine. If we get it wrong, we destroy the education system. To me, that kind of defines an issue. So I'll talk a bit about that. But I'll begin with and focus on the communities of practice, but I'll shade that into personalization and hit copyright on the way. So it's not going to be a nice, neat, segmented thing, but I never could do nice, neat, segmented things anyways. So we'll break for today. Those of you who are losing today, I'm sorry to see you go. And I wish you could come back
But as I said, they'll video it, so I hope you get something out of that. And for those of you who aren't here, I'll see you tomorrow. And I'm sorry I covered your topic already, but I think it'll be okay. So thanks a lot, everyone, and I'll see you tomorrow.